Not as well as the recording off the machine. And the second part, I will share my screen for the notes. So you'll see something coming up shortly. Slowly does its process and should say, "Hey, I think I'm sharing." And it hasn't launched yet. Working on it. There we go. At least on my end, a little green box showed up. Not little green men, but little green box.
Good.
That's
Yeah,
always
I see.
important. Awesome. The second piece of what I'm going to do with is my cell phone. It's on vibrate and away from the mic. That way we don't sound like I just came out of a Buddhist temple going, All right. So other things. When the Zoom is done, it's recording and bringing everything out. I record everything Zoom lets me record,
Yeah.
and we'll share with you the raw files, and you can use them for promotion, content, etc. Just credit source. That's the only I can ask for in that space. Then I will edit the files later on, and when I go to release it on the podcast through Buzzsprout then ships it to everybody else. I'll give you a release date and time and any artwork I do related to it. If you have any artwork you want me to use for a thumbnail, send it to me. And just keep in mind, I'm putting the Knack for Business logo, season episode, and also the title on the artwork. But otherwise, I'm good. Life will motor along, and yeah.
So would this be an audio at the end, or is it a video and audio?
Well, oddly enough, you should ask that question. So, what my grand plan is: A, do the audio production for sure. I'm starting to leverage a little more on YouTube. So, season three has not started. Season three's recordings have started since September, but nothing's gone into production mode as of yet. So, I'm just finishing off two more podcasts from season two, and then season three production is. It's live from the velodrome, and I'm pushing out. So some of it I'm playing with, like you're presenting super well. So I don't foresee any issues. And whether it's the three of us kind of going flip, flip, flip between the screens, or just have you talking, in which case make it awkward then, or I might do clips, to make it work better. So
All right.
cool.
And
All right.
time wise, sorry, Bernie, how long would it take?
Release date, stand
No, I mean
by.
for the recording. How long would you aim to do the recording for? Like an hour or 45 minutes? What would you like?
I've booked an hour. We've booked an hour. The outcome might be anywhere from 30 to 45 minute output. On average, it's been like that for recordings after editing and snipping and snapping and pulling the pants up tighter up and going, okay, I'm ready to run.
Okay. All right.
Cool.
So I'm yours. Let's
Sir,
let it
thank you.
roll.
Thank you so much. So I've done our sound check and off to the races we go. A Knack for Business, Season 3, Episode E022, October 16th, 2024. Welcome to the Season 3 of the Knack for Business podcast. Today's topic is From the Ashes of Beirut to the Boardroom, Robin Ayoub's Journey of Resilience. Your hosts are Bernie Franscrud from Creative Insight and Wayne Pratt from Motivate You Inc. So, what can you expect from the Knack for Business podcast? Well, the aim is to help you find your feet in the business world, whether you're just starting out or you've been at it for a while. We have something for everyone. In each episode, they dive deep into a particular area of business and explore the ins and outs of that subject. They interview guests that are experts in their field, who share their success stories and their experiences. They offer practical tips and advice. Our guest today is Robin Ayoub from Lionbridge. Robin is a distinguished executive with over 2 decades of experience in the language industry, having spearheaded the growth of LexiTech International from a small company to a global industry leader, resulting in the acquisition by CLS Communication and integration into Lionbridge Technologies, where he now serves as a vice president of sales and general manager for Canada. Beyond his corporate success, Robin is a celebrated thought leader, hosted to the Localization Fireside Chat podcast at l10nffiresidechat.com. Through this platform, he explores critical topics such as AI's impact on the industry and the future of language services fostering a vibrant community within the global language sector. His leadership skills are further recognized through his role as the elected president of the Canadian Language Industry Association, where he continues to drive innovation, where he continues to drive innovative strategies and excellence in the field. Robin, welcome. What's your favorite quote or saying, sir?
So I want to first thank you for hosting me on this podcast. I was looking so forward to meeting you both and engaging in this conversation. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate being a guest on your podcast. I wish you all the best on this particular episode and overall in the journey of podcasting. So my favorite quote, and I just finished another recording on another podcast as well, use the same favorite quote because it's my personal and near dear to my heart, is never give up. Go over, go under, go around, go through if you have to, but never give up. If you believe in something and you want to accomplish that something, I'm sure everybody can find a way to achieve whatever they put their minds into. So that's the bottom line for me, is never give up on anything you want to do in life.
You know, I think based on that, your transition from coming from Beirut to Canada, that must have taken a lot of push, there are a lot of unknowns. Can you describe what that is like to our audience, so they understand? You know, being an entrepreneur is a push into something you don't know about, but changing countries even more so.
And so thanks for the question. This is a pretty interesting question for me because, you know, having lived in that part of the world, which we now talk about in the news day in, day out, I guess it rings near and dear to my heart. Every so often I forget about that, but then all of a sudden the news resurfaces and brings back all the moments that I've lived in that country up to my early 20s before I left. So I grew up in a small town in the south part of the country. I was born in Beirut, but my parents moved around in the country. My dad worked for the Lebanese army, and he moved around army life, whatever they stationed him, he took us with him. Five kids in the family, mom and dad, were seven family members. And when I was eight, I believe, when my younger brother was born, and the year was he was born, the Civil War started. And we started accelerating the moving around because of the Civil War, where the Civil War gets hot, we move to another town. So during that movement around, we ended up back in Beirut again. And this is where I was like almost in my young teenage years, 13, 14 years old. So having through all this, one of the things, the few things that got embedded into my personality, into my, I want to say, business DNA since I was a kid, I had to grow up fast. I remember there is no time for, living the chasing the butterfly kind of a young age kind of kid. You know, at the age of 7, 8 years old, you know, you had to learn to stand up on both feet and either do two things: find a way to survive, find a way to make a living for the rest of my siblings, mom and dad. They didn't have a lot of money. We come from a poor family. We're not, you know, the aristocrats of Lebanon. There's no such thing. There is no such thing at all. We come from a very poor, family. And we, mom and dad, you know, dad is living off of an army salary, which is nothing. And there's like five kids. I mean, how do you survive? So here's me at the age of 8 years old. I have to discover all this. And, you know, one of the experiences that I tell people about at the age of 9, 10 years old, I think around that time, my dad was visiting the house, I guess, he was on leave from the army post, and he ended up buying me and my mom, I guess my mom was a young mother, and she bought us a knitting machine, I remember. And I remember the knitting machine, they put it on a table, and I was too short for the table. So my dad pulled, I remember, I still have that visual in my head. My dad put the table on its side, saw the legs of the table so he can bring it down for my height. My mom gave me a chair. They put a whole bunch of pillows on it so I can stand, you know, I can learn this stupid thing. And I ended up learning how to knit sweaters at a young age. So here's the process. I go to school. I come back from school. I knit the sweaters. My mom sewed the sweaters together. And on the weekend, I had to put them in a bag and go knock on doors selling them. And the motivation was, do not come back home with any sweater unsold. You have to sell every sweater. There's a price on this. I can't give them away. I have to sell them. So that's me at the age, 10 years old, I was doing this. And I did that for a couple of years until we moved and found a different ways of surviving, I guess.
Wow, no magic beans coming home there.
Nope. So this is just to get you started with the whole idea, of my personality, what shaped it to be what it is right now, and the experiences that led me to where I am right now. So again, when I say like never give up, I lived it, I survived it, I found a way around it, I broke through in some cases to find a way to get to who I want to be, which basically at that point, just survived to the next day.
Robin, how did your, I'm being thrown in a deep end in leadership. What stuck? What didn't? What did you have to relearn? Tell me about how this shaped you.
So when I, just skip all the experiences in Lebanon, now the decision has been made to move to Canada. So when I got to Canada, I didn't speak English. Zero. I spoke French and I spoke Arabic. So here's a challenge. I landed in Atlantic Canada, which I thought, I will be communicating. I found it's not a bad thing. I mean, I found the French is acceptable and I can communicate with it, but I found it a lot easier for me to learn another language, to be honest with you, because I need to work in that language. I need to understand that language. So first is you need to learn fast and talk about leadership. In leadership, a lot of times people are like, oh, I got to take a course. I got to go to university, study 3-4 years. Yeah, you got to do that. But in some cases, you got to learn on your feet. You got to learn fast. You got to adapt to a new environment. You got to reskill yourself on the fly. There is no time for you to waste. So one of the big challenges for me is to learn the language of the work that I'm going to be doing or where I'm going to be employed. And one of the things that I keep working with my staff now, and I work my previous companies that I worked with, the staff that I worked with before, is resiliency in terms of knowing, in terms of learning, in terms of updating the knowledge that you currently have. And, there is no time for people to feel sorry for themselves. Time is very precious. You got to keep learning, keep moving forward. And we're having this conversation today. If you've listened to some of my podcasts that I do, the conversation today is about AI and how people are worried about AI and how people are scared about AI. And I keep saying, look, it's a competition between the people that knows AI and the people that don't know AI. That's the fundamental point of it. AI is not going to replace anybody. It's going to replace the people that don't know it. And that has been the case in anything that we've learned, in anything that I've learned throughout my life, my career, et cetera. It's either I learn it or somebody else will replace me that knows it better.
The immediate takeaway I'm getting from the life experiences to where you're at now, like coming into Canada, my parents immigrated to Canada and they found certain things the same and some things not at all the same. My mom was remarking that we use a lot of sugar here in Canada as opposed to other places. It's little tweaks like that. But I think having that change, especially as a kid, excuse me, I think that makes you more neuroplastic. In other words, you learn to change as opposed to I'm in a rut. I'm okay with a rut. That's true. But that's pretty fascinating to hear that transition. Now you've gone from learning the language. Now you started a business called LexiTech. So how did what made you kind of go, that's a ticket? And then how did you scale it? Because now you're relying on your guile and wit, but there's more to it, I imagine.
Correct. So so before I started with LexiTech, Bernie, I was a technologist. I was in the technology business. So I've done everything from, being a system engineer for a telecom company to being a programmer to be, this is where I graduated from. I did my degree in Lebanon in computer science. But, I keep saying like doing a degree in the middle of a civil war in a country in a computer science. I mean, what are you learning? I mean, everything I've learned in that degree is completely evaporated by the time I hit the border in Canada. You know, I mean, the computers are different, the system is different. And then we're talking about 80s, 90s. I mean, talk about today. Even today's graduates are graduating and they're saying, what did I learn? And they're coming to find the real life a little bit different. So I was coming back, I remember, from a business trip, and I was on a flight heading home, and I was living in Moncton at the time. And the individual was sitting beside me on the plane, happened to run a company in an industry. It was called the translation industry or the language industry. And at the time when the idea of working for a language company, it was introduced to me. I thought it was, you know, either a programming language, or I didn't know like there was an industry that you would probably give your business to translate content from one language to another, because I was not exposed to it. And my first conversation about the topic was with that individual. Nevertheless, 2 hours later, now I work for a company that is in the translation business. And my job was, as a business development, head of business development for that company, is to grow the company, obviously. So how do I grow this company? So my question was to myself and to everybody around, what is the expectation? What is the business plan? Where do you want to go from here? So obviously I'm asking question progressive way, in terms of trying to get to where we want to go and want to know how am I going to get there. So the business plan was given to me. We need to reach X by 5 years. How do we get there? Now that's my job. So I started thinking about, how do I get there? And this company is based in Moncton. They've got a few things on the go, but you know, in order for us to get to where we want to go, we want to, you know, blow the doors out of this thing. And we want to get to where we want to go very quickly. 5 years, not a long time. And when I come from the technology industry, I'm thinking like, you know, I used to work in an industry where the item used to sell, it's like, you know, $250,000 to $1 million deal. And now we're coming to an industry where we sell things per word. And the per word rate is like $0.25 per word. Like, how many of those I have to sell to get to like $20-30 million business plan that we want to get to at the end of 5 years? So it's a bit of a challenge. So my style has always been, in business development, has been always go hard at the top of the ticket that you're trying to sell. Identify the target. Don't start at the bottom. Start at the top and see where you end up. So I made a few phone calls, I remember, and the first account that I won, it was like maybe a strike of luck at the time. Things are repeatable then, but they're not repeatable now. The environment has shifted, obviously. And what we've done back then, maybe it's doable now, but less likely. So within about a couple of weeks, I landed the first customer. We're billing them across close to about $1 million a year. So that was unheard of back then. You win a customer that's $1 million a year. And, you know, a normal customer without the government actually giving you a contract that is worth $20-30 million over 5-6 years, it's unheard of. So, and I started repeating this. I started repeating this exercise. So within 5 years, as my bio says, within 5 years, we're now at a critical mass as a company that the owner started looking to sell the company. And at the time, that company was owned by the Irving family out of New Brunswick. So they started, you know, wanted to sell it. They ended up selling it to CLS Communication. And where I continued to work for that company, I was part of the deal, actually. And when you, I don't know if anybody has been involved in buying and selling service companies at the time, you buy two things, revenue and the expertise that contained within that revenue, the people that works for that organization. So that's how I got started. That's how I grew the company and did the first transaction. Learned a lot, learned a brand new business, brand new product, brand new services. And this is where people tell me, like, today, even today, when you hire somebody, do you know the product? I just can't comprehend that question when somebody's talking to me and say, you know, we want to sell whatever, the widget or the service. And the first question, do you know the product? It doesn't matter to me if I know the product or not. The product or services are irrelevant to me because I can learn that on the fly. The biggest question for me right now, from any business development or any salesperson, how fast can you put revenue in the machine? That's the biggest question.
Hit that one. Robin, one thing that interests me is sort of when you're reading the business press, being on the wrong side of a merger seems to be everyone's nightmare. And you actually took your company and merged into another one. And I'm interested in what you found. What was the wins? What was the, oh, I can't do this anymore? The, I wouldn't have done it like that. How did that unpack for you?
So, you know, when I was, you know, when I came to join this industry, I left a very good job for in the telecom business. And on my way out, I remember one of the executives I was working with at the telecom company, he told me, he said, oh, man, you're going to go work for these organizations. And he named the organization. I won't name it here for you. He said, oh, my God, these guys are going to be cracking the whip. They're going to be, you know, working you like a dog day in, day out. And I still remember this conversation. It was in front of the elevator on the seventh floor in St. John, New Brunswick. And I remember this conversation till today because it was embedded in who I am. He was talking about who I am as a person. And that, although I have a lot of respect for people, when these statements are made, it sort of leaves a statement in your mind, in your personality. You can't forget them. I said to him, and I remember this conversation very well, I said, if I need to work for anybody that's going to tell me what to do and how much to work and how hard to work, I will quit tomorrow because it's embedded in my personality, who I am. You don't need to tell me to wake up in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, start making emails and doing phone calls. That's who I am. I don't need anybody to clock me because if I'm not working more than 80 hours a week, I don't earn my living.
That's a really good point.
So back to your question as to why most of these, you know, and I see it in the news, like you guys see it in the news and you guys see it all the time, emergent acquisition for any company. It's a nightmare for the employee, right? But however, we all know this. I mean, if you take any company in Canada, United States, North America, and Europe, when these transactions are happening, individuals at the top of the ticket who are organizing these transactions are automatically diagnosing the entire employee demographic for any company. And they're saying in their mind, we're going to classify them into an A, B, and C. So who are they going to keep? They're going to keep the A and the B, and they're going to probably look at the C if they have room for them, or if they don't have room for them, they'll be the first one on the chopping block. Fortunately for me and for the organization that I work for, we only retain A and Bs, and hopefully the Bs would graduate to be an A. And that's the trajectory that we've always been on. So in any of those transactions over the years that I've been involved in my life, in the career in Canada here, is that most of the transaction I've been involved with, not many people lost their jobs. Because as a good manager, you either graduate the C's to be a B and show them the way, or the B to the A, you put them on that trajectory, or the individuals who are not performing, you already got rid of them.
So is that process also the motivation? How do you keep them motivated during these transitions, whether it's a merger or acquisition, or you know what, we've been at this for 3-4 years, having a good solid run. But there is changes coming on the horizon. Is that also part of the motivation piece that you, and if it is, how do you motivate them?
So the motivation to do better is leading by example. And again, it sounds like a repetition for me because I was just on a podcast talking about the same topic. Example, for instance, I will never ask anybody to do something that I'm not willing to do, or I'm not willing to learn how to do it, because there's a lot of expertise I don't have. There's many people who have expertise on my team that I'm not good at. But if you were to ask me to learn that expertise and to become good at it, I'm willing to learn it and I become good at it. So I'm not going to ask any one of my team members or any of my staff that are working with me right now, or they work with me in the past, to do things that I'm not willing A, to learn or do, or to do it better than they do. So lead from the trenches. That's what it is. I will never sit at my desk and say, you do this, you do that. No, I'm in there. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, either by showing them how it's done. And they get motivated by that. I mean, everybody gets motivated by that. When you see, you know, and I never, ever treated anybody, oh, I'm your boss, you should listen to me. No, I always been a dialogue Maybe that's a better thing to do it. Maybe that's a better way to do it. I don't know. Maybe there's merits for both. When somebody says, I'm the boss, you should do as I tell you to do, or convince me or show me the way so I can do it exactly the way you want to, by dialoguing it, by talking about it, by showing them that this is, if you do it this way, this is the gains, these are the benefits, versus not doing it, and here are the issues that you're gonna be doing. Not just for me. I mean, this is a logical thing. I'm not saying anything in this conversation that it's not logical. It is logical. You either do what the logic dictate to be done, because nobody's gonna ask you to do anything illogical. Some managers will ask you to do something illogical. I'm not sure what their situation is. Hopefully they're not working for those companies anymore. But some people do. I won't.
So you are on the governance body of some language organizations. I assume that one of the conversations that comes up is AI. Does AI impact your industry, and how?
Of course. So AI is impacting all the knowledge-based industry, and knowledge-based industry is where the language industry participate. So we're facing few things. One is, when we talk about AI in the language industry, and we start from the customer, which is the market is pushing the language industry to evolve, to get on board with AI, because the market has got two things. One is the availability of the technology. It is no longer, we're democratizing the entire technology now to be ubiquitous, to be available to everybody. It is no longer constrained to be used by the few. It is everybody's available. This technology is available to everybody. The genie is out of the bottle. So we either learn how to work with it and not learn how to work with it, and we have two options. Either sell those companies. Our industry has 19,000 companies in it globally. So these companies are faced with the decision, either I get on board with AI, embed it into my technology, make sense of it, and find the business formula that allows me to serve my customer better using AI and give AI as an option to my customers, and or ignore it, continue on the track that I'm in, and see my business dwindling and eventually exiting. It's not going to go away.
I think that AI does a value add. It's like adding, you know, spices to a meal that you're cooking, right? If it's bland to start off with, just jazz it up or you make it look prettier. That's really interesting.
So I was just going to mention one more thing on the AI. Customers are driven by two factors. One is cost savings and convenience. The cost saving is pretty interesting. Now, people are pushing the envelope a little bit. And me, I speak like three languages, and I can see when content is coming to me by AI, from AI. And, you know, I can tell that it's AI. I can understand it, but sometimes I get lost because AI does the hallucinations sometimes, and which sort of like misses the messages. So you still need a human in the loop, I would say, if you are going to perfect a message, if you are going to be understood, and making sure that you're not saying things that you're not supposed to be saying, either by writing an article, generating something, generating a specific content, and or you're modifying something. So human in the loop is very important. The disagreement on, and not disagreement, I mean, the challenge right now is how much human do I inject in the process? It doesn't matter if it's language or a journalist or writing a book or whatever. How much human do I inject in order for me to get the message across to the audience I'm trying to target? Does it need to be the Mona Lisa of the, you know, of the art industry, or does it need, or is it okay just by, you know, conveying a message in a simplistic way to them? This is where the disagreement right now. How much human and how much effort do I inject into the process?
Robin, I have a question.
Go ahead.
You're a podcaster, and at a risk of being inside baseball, as a podcaster, what have you found interesting about the process? What have you found enlightening? How do you pick your guests? What's the process?
So about a year and a half now, I started in March 2023. I started in March 2023 when I had the idea of doing a podcast. And I looked around and I found that the most of the podcasts are, especially in my industry, in our industry, the language industry, I found them a bit dry, to be honest with you. And I always thought to myself, I felt like, you know, I talk to a lot of people, and you guys, you know, probably do the same thing too. You take people for coffee, you sit at a restaurant, you have a conversation with somebody. And that idea sharing in a relaxed environment, I found it missing. So what I thought I thought, well, let me start a fireside chat. And until today, I feel like when I get into a conversation with somebody over my podcast, I say, look, bring your coffee. I'll bring my coffee and we'll record the conversation. Why? It's because I can't sit with you at Starbucks next to my house because you happen to be in Spain or somewhere. So let's do a coffee together at a normal coffee chat. And you know what I really got out of this is the amount of conversation I'm having and the amount of success people are telling me are having resulting in the conversation with me, because they come in natural, relaxed, no PowerPoint, no slide deck, let's present, no presentation. And people are telling me like they're, you know, I heard people telling me like, I'm going to the gym, I'm listening to a podcast. And you're listening to my podcast at a gym? Man, I'm listening to the Bonnie M so I can get through my conversation. My exercise. And they're telling me like, it's easy to listen to. They can follow the conversation and they can also get gems that they can take notes of, they can learn from, and they didn't really have to sit through a boring conversation to get that. So I am happy that I'm delivering something that it's easy to listen to follow. People are like, I'm booked from 2 months. You know, I do them every week on Friday. I'm booked 2 months in advance. And now I'm getting people. At the beginning, I was selecting specific individuals to come and speak to me. I still do that when I want to send an invite to people. But now I'm getting people reaching out to me. They're saying, I would like to be on your podcast, which is great.
So you've worked in small business. You've worked in bigger business. You've worked in other industries. You work in other languages. What advice would you give small business owners to scale up with?
So one, you know, this is one of my favorite conversation that I have. And I think somebody mentioned not too long ago that there was an award being given this year. And I think somebody mentioned that, you know, the mentor award, mentor to businesses award, I guess my candidacy is being put out there for one of them, which is great. And that's exactly what I do. I feel like after everything I've learned, I don't need anybody to pay me as a consultant to go talk to these individuals. I do it for free because I love what I do. I love talking to people and showing them, not necessarily, they don't need to listen to me. I don't want anybody to listen to me if that doesn't make sense. But if it does make sense and you want to grab a couple of gems from our conversation, I'm willing to have that conversation day in, day out. It doesn't matter if it's after hours, whatever it's available to them. So one of the advice is learn from others. Don't get boxed into your own ideas. Don't sit down and say, well, that worked last year. It may not work this year. Expand the conversation. Talk to as many people as you can, me or somebody else, it doesn't matter. But expand those conversations, have those dialogues, see what works and what did not work, and adapt your business. The biggest problem with entrepreneur is they are the owner of the idea, and that idea owner is the one who is managing the business forward. That's not necessarily a good formula. The idea owner sometimes needs to park it and have somebody to manage the business to the next level. You know, how many companies I've been involved with, that's what they did. They hired me to drive them, to drive their business. They did not, you know, disappear into the shadow. Of course not. But they stayed involved, but they gave somebody like me the rein to grow the business. Some people would say, well, I'm good at growing business. Good for you. You should stay that way. Fine. It's the flexibility and the removing that pride that comes with a business ownership, take it out of the equation a little bit and step back and say, do I have the capability to drive this thing to the next level? If that's your objective may be like, I want to sell the company. Your objective may not be growth, but if your objective is growth and take your company to the next level, step back, do a self-assessment first, and find other people that you can talk to They can share ideas with you on what to do to the next, take your business to the next level.
Robin, one thing that interests me that has nothing to do with business is the three of us are Canadian or in Canada, and there was a mini scandal a month ago about a governor general who can't speak French even though she's been taking lessons. English was your third language, and you're frighteningly fluent. How is that? Is that a natural gift? Did you work at it day and night? Why are you so good at language management?
No, I think it's my my subconscious. I don't know if you guys heard of this concept. You can learn by your subconscious. And I think subconsciously I was tuned to languages since I was a kid. And I, you know, to be frank and honest with you, I have not gone to any school to learn English. And all I did is I listened, made mistakes. This is the biggest thing. People are afraid of learning another language. Oh, no, I got to learn the verbs. I got to learn the in French, you call it conjugaison. I got to learn the, you know, the rules, the grammars before I can put a sentence together. And when I feel absolutely confident, I'm going to try the language. To be honest with you, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It takes a lifetime to learn that. And I didn't have the luxury of time. I got to work so I can earn a living. So I remember my first job, I was working for an insurance company. I wrote the program. I'm good at writing programs in for computer programs. Now I need to write a memo to show the user how to use the program. Well, good luck with that. I can't speak English. I know computer language, but I don't know how to put this memo together. So I remember my colleagues at work, they all came together and they, you know, standing over my shoulder and I'm typing on an old mainframe and showing me what to write in English. The support that I got from my coworkers just for trying to learn the language, it was incredible. And that pushed me to learn it. And I see now, I know a lot of my friends that have been in this country for 40, 50 years, their English is terrible. Their French is terrible. And I feel like, what? Why? I mean, I wasn't born in this language. I wish I was, but I wasn't. I could have avoided all the war torture. But to learn it here at an older age and to adapt to it, I'm surprised myself. I listen to myself speaking on a podcast sometimes. I feel like, this is me? I can't even believe it.
You're doing fantastic. I had had an accountant one time working with me. And he's French Canadian. He says, Bernie. And he had a really gravelly voice. I was, Bernie, the best way to learn it is watch The Simpsons in French. And I'm thinking, oh, okay. Says, you know, that way, it's, you know, you start watching it, and you start absorbing it. But like you said, once there's a reason to focus on it, you start exercising that part of the muscle, so to speak, in the brain.
It's amazing when an individual, as a human being, as a humanity, when an individual is faced with tough choice, like I'm talking tough choice, you know, like take an example. Somebody survived a, God forbid, a plane crash on an island. They don't know anything, and they're now on an island. And they have, like, the survival instinct as a human being kicks in. And trust me, you will learn things you never thought it possible to be learned, because you're faced with a detriment. I remember when I was a young teenager, I was like in my 18, 19 years old, the bombing campaign continued on our area where we lived in Beirut. My dad gave me a task at that age, 18 years old. I said, what do you want? He said, I want you to build a bunker in the backyard of the house. I want to build a bunker. Like, I have no clue what to do here. I have to build a bunker. So I built a bunker in the backyard of the house. That is, I think it was 5 meters below the surface, 5 meters below the surface. For those in feet, that's about 18 feet below the surface. No, more than that. Yeah, 18 feet, 3.3. 18 feet below the surface. And I had to build walls that are cement reinforced concrete with rebar and steel reinforced walls. I had to zigzag the door. I had to layer the roof of the bunker in a way that nothing crash on top of that thing can take it away. And that way, I did that like in the 80s. So my father continues the conversation later on, years after that, with my uncle, who's still in Lebanon. And just out of conversation a few years ago, he's asking him, does this thing still around? He said, yep, nothing penetrated, and saw many wars and nothing penetrated. I didn't know that. I have no clue how to do this.
Next thing you're going to start telling us, you start building pyramids, you know, as a side job.
You know, if somebody asks me to do it, I'll do it. I'll find a way to do it.
That is incredible. And by the way, kudos to you for building something that said, yeah, not today.
There you go.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So, you know, this, I guess the challenges you're facing right now are less austere. And they're dealing with within your market space. So what trends do you see happening in the language space and translations?
So one of the biggest trends right now is taking place right now is adaptation, or taking a look at where we are as an industry and adapting to the new world that we're going to be in, and specifically around technology. The language industry, like any other industry, has been, they don't like change. Nobody likes change. You know, change is a bit bad word. And the change generally happens, and I've seen it happen in the telecom industry. I've seen it happen in the printing industry. Generally, the change takes place outside of the industry, and it's forced upon an industry. And now the industry has to react to it. The printing industry saw this. The telecom industry, the same idea. New technology comes in, or new way of doing things comes in. And now the industry has to react to it. The language industry is no different. I mean, most of the changes that they're going through, the translation industry right now, or the language industry, it's coming from the outside of the industry, imposed on the industry. If the industry was left alone and things were great, and you know, financially the world is going into a flourishing of dollars being thrown on the industry, nobody will do anything. Nobody would change and do anything. And I remember this article that came in a couple of years ago, I can't remember when. There's this big YouTube personality who is always taking his videos and translating them to another language. And he was not happy with how long it takes, how much it cost, etc. So he decided, he said, okay, I'm opening my own artificial intelligence company, and I'm doing my own translation for my own videos. So that clicked in now, that if you don't meet the requirements, somebody will meet it. Somebody will create it. As I said in my earlier question, answer to your question, the genie is out of the bottle. The biggest trend right now in our industry is how do we take AI's power and harness it to make the industry better, to re-flourish the industry, reinvent the industry, call it localization 2.0, if you will. To reinvent the industry, reinvigorate the industry, not to kill the industry. That's completely different. That's a completely bad topic to be talking about. It is. There's a huge opportunity in AI, and the industry needs to seize that opportunity. And I'm doing a keynote speaking here in a conference here coming up in Saudi Arabia in November. And that's the key topic that I'm going to be targeting, is that how do you take AI and harness the power of AI, and how is dependent on who is what application you're going to be using in, and which business is going to be targeting the AI. And the second thing that is going on with our industry right now, it's pretty interesting, is interpretation. Because during COVID, you know, we were, before COVID, everybody was relaxed doing business face to face. COVID has forced the industry to go remote, have forced our services to diverse, to offer more remote services. And one of the things that it's really saw, we had it before, but one of the things that really saw an increase during and post-COVID is interpretation. Think about medical interpretation, you know, talking to a doctor or an immigrant coming to the country, talking to the officers. It doesn't matter if it's in the United States or Canada. Think about, you know, somebody going through the legal process of some sort, and you need an interpreter with you to help you through that. And the technology is revolving around that. So now you have over-the-phone interpretation. You have remote simultaneous interpretation, where you can be on a call like Zoom right now, and we have an interpreter facilitating the conversation. There's more of that now. We had it before, but now it's accelerated its development, and it's in a propagation, if you will.
Just a quick sidebar question. Do you do, because once you mentioned doing translation, live translation as the person speaking, you also do sign language?
Yes, of course. It's part of it, yeah. And sign language is in every language. So think about a global company such the one I work for, LineBridge, which we exist in many countries around the world. We have 6,000-7,000 employees serving many, many customers around the world. Everything we do, like in Canada, you can only do English or French. And if the customer asks for another language, fine. But globally speaking, most of these global customers are doing things in hundreds of languages. So whatever we do, we have to do it in multiple languages.
So I guess that's kind of AI proof.
So far, I mean, AI is, it's always up, you know, it's going through an evolution right now. So far, it's AI proof. However, you know, I can always hear the bits and pieces of news of somebody's creating something. Somebody created a glove the other day that does ASL using AI. I'm not sure how valid that is or how viable it is, but there are ideas around that.
Something that is interesting to me based on, I'd love your take on, 30 years ago, all the talk was inventing a new language so that everyone spoke one. I think they called it Esperanto. And that went precisely absolutely nowhere. And I was just wondering if your take, whether it made a mistake, whether it was silly at the outset, whether it didn't get a chance. What is your take on a universal language? And also, how did English become the standard? Is it the universal language?
So, you know, if you're asking a physicist and you're asking this in a very objective way, I would say universal language is a good thing to do, because then everybody will speak in the same language. We have less wars, etc. However, humanity is humanity, and we come from not necessarily who we are as a human today, but where we come from as a human. You know, there's a huge amount of history, culture, all that stuff is connected to languages and connected to the specific language that this individual was born with, and they speak, their heritage, their families, where they come from, European, Middle Eastern, Africans, it doesn't matter, Asian, wherever you come from, there is a huge attachment to that language, because this is your heritage. And that's how we were brought up as a humanity. And that's why you need that, if you call it the bridging, that translation function that facilitate the conversation between those demographics, right? Now, if you were to say to somebody, hey, I want you to forget your Arabic language, for instance, because I speak Arabic, I can say that. And I want you to learn this universal language. That's it. That's what we're going to speak from. It would be like, you might find like a small minority of people that will adopt that, and no wonder it withered away. But at the same time, people are going to say, no, you know, I want to speak the language of my ancestors, and my kid's going to have to learn that language and speak the language of our ancestors. And funny you say that, because there is a huge amount of effort right now being put together regarding the revival or resurrection or the preservation of the Aboriginal language, for instance, in Canada, right? So Aboriginal language is a very important topic in Canada right now being discussed, you know, at a federal level, at provincial level, it doesn't matter what level it is. You know, large corporations are talking about Aboriginal languages. And in Canada, there's, you know, I didn't know that until I got into the industry. Not just one. There is like hundreds of languages. Every tribe spoke its own languages in Canada. And the Canadian language is trying to, the federal government is trying to select the few of those languages and say, we're going to adopt these few languages. But there are languages being disintegrated. Why? Is because not many people are speaking them. So AI is playing a role in preserving these languages. They're collecting these content, these bytes, these ideas, or these languages, the acronym, the lexicon, and whatever they're using, and they're putting them into an AI function where I can now preserve those languages. I don't know if you guys had a chance to play with some of those AI tools out there. For instance, you can take somebody's voice, you can put it into AI, and you can tell it to do whatever you want them to do. I tried it. It works in any language.
Well, it speaks spouse.
I'm sorry?
It speaks spouse.
That's right. It speaks spouse. I love that. I might need that someday.
the get out of jail card.
Yeah. To get out of jail. That's right.
I find two very different cultures in business in Canada, and small business in Canada. One are basically technicians. They learn their job, and doing their job is their business. And then others are a bit more what I would call pure entrepreneurs. And I'm guessing from your take, from what I'm hearing, you're more of a traditional entrepreneur. Find a need, fill it, whether that's brain surgery or tell me a story. What advice do you have for entrepreneurs?
So in any business idea, over the years, I through the experiences that I've had, I was able to sort of like distill all this. At the beginning of my career, I was taking a product and selling it to somebody, right? Now I'm looking for what is the problem and what solution do I bring? And if an entrepreneur out there listening to this, and you have a business and or you have a product or you have a service, focus on what is the problem and what is the solution that your services or your product are going to solve. People are looking for solutions. The markets are looking for solutions. Nobody is buying anything nowadays because it's nice to have. Maybe somebody who are the 1%, I guess some people call them. But most, the 99% of us are looking for a solution to a problem. Does that work?
You know what? It's interesting. There's a colleague of mine. He says, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.
That's right.
And so it's, you know, just because something ain't running right, that's a hint. It's the starting point.
That's right. Robin, and there's always solutions. There's always problems in this world. We have not solved all the problems out there. There's many problems that need solutions.
Robin, if this sparks the interest of somebody and they go, hey, I want to reach out to Robin. Sure. How do they dial you in?
My LinkedIn profile is up and running, and I've got, I'm very active on LinkedIn, very easy to reach. I've got my phone number there. I've got my email address. Everybody is welcome to reach out anytime. Have a coffee, have a conversation, and see where it goes.
I love it. So folks, if there are any hidden mysteries that you need to strive for, Robin's your man. And if it's about language, maybe not the language of love just yet, but yeah, who knows?
We may be able to help there too.
I want to say thank you, Robin Ayub.
You're welcome.
My co-host Wayne Pratt, and you, the Knack for Business listeners. This has been a really entertaining hour, and I appreciate it. I'd also like to say thanks to Carl Richards from Podcast Solutions Made Simple, a renowned podcast expert. Fred Crouch, who's the Property Wizard podcaster, where I'm a co-host. Jovan Stryka from At Hive, a co-working space that's more than just a space. Melanie Weber, my invaluable business partner. And Dwayne Pratt from Motivate You, Inc., who serves both as a coach and a co-host of these podcasts. To reach us, info@creativeinsight.com. It's info@KREATIVENSIGHT.com, or creativeinsight.com is the website. Wayne, how can folks reach you, sir?
Depending on which language they speak, best way is my website, motiveu.ca, MOTIVE, the numeral 8, the letter U.ca, and my email is Wayne@motiveu.ca.